It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a lighthearted Thanksgiving controversy over which holiday food best represents states like Wisconsin and Minnesota. We'll hear what's going on and hear your thoughts, too.
First, a new report last week highlighted some eye-opening statistics on Wisconsin's arrest rates of African Americans in the state.
According to the numbers, dozens of Wisconsin's largest police departments lock up more African Americans than people of other races. What's alarming some observers is that these arrest rates exceed the 3-to-1 disparity in Ferguson, Missouri.
Ariel Chung reported this story. She's a crime reporter for the Appleton Post Crescent and a member of Gannett Media's Wisconsin I team. Ariel, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the inclusion part of it. How did you decide which departments to include in the survey?
Well, our project was in connection with a USA Today National report, and their analysis mainly focused on police departments with at least 200 arrests over 2011 and 2012, and agencies with in a community with a black population of at least 500 people. So those were kind of the cutoff points, and then it also depended largely on which departments reported their arrest data to the FBI.
So how did the analysis work? How did you go about comparing the Wisconsin police departments that fit that first criteria?
USA Today provided us with the raw data from the FBI, and basically the way to kind of make those numbers more comparable, because we have, 61 departments in Wisconsin with a wide variety of populations, was to look at the arrest rates. So per 1,000 black residents or per 1,000 non-black residents, how many arrests were we seeing over that two-year period?
Now, what were some of the big takeaways? What did you find?
Well, both in Wisconsin and on a national level, while we had a lot of kind of chatter about Ferguson's 3-to-1 arrest disparity of black people, kind of the main takeaway was that that's not uncommon, and that's not even the largest disparity we saw.
And what was the largest disparity?
In Wisconsin, it turned out Wauwatosa had the highest numbers, the largest disparities between the arrests. I think overall, a black person in Wauwatosa was about 30 times more likely to be arrested.
And you're saying that wasn't uncommon when you looked at the nation as a whole. Do you have a sense of how Wisconsin and maybe Wauwatosa compared to the rest of the country?
I think they were pretty much on par. It looked like of the, 3,000 or so departments that USA Today looked at, it was about half had similar or larger disparities. So we were pretty on par with the nation.
How do different areas of crime represent, say, when you looked at violent crime arrest versus something like drug use and manufacturing?
That was actually a big part of the story, because the police chief that I interviewed and a sociologist from the University of Wisconsin both mentioned that there are certain crimes that are more enforcement-driven. So instead of incidents like robbery or assault, where a victim is reporting their suspects' age and height and different statistics, enforcement-driven crimes are more police-based, and it just sort of depends on where the police are or whether they decide to arrest someone as opposed to giving them a ticket. And those are the crimes, like you said, like drug possession, OWI, the nonviolent crimes. And that was where the sociologist, Pamela Oliver, kind of said that might be where you can see more of a disparity that might be indicative of, something that needs examined.
Now, I know you spoke to the police about some of these disparities, too, in Wauwatosa and also in Appleton, which is another city that popped up on your list. What did they say about these numbers?
Well, I actually spoke with our interim chief here in Appleton, Chief James Lewis, who was also police chief in Green Bay for, 7 or 8 years. He worked in a Los Angeles suburb. He worked in New Haven, Connecticut. And he, like many officers I've spoken to on this issue, said that you can't consider an arrest disparity as indicative of a bias without looking at so many other factors. And that was something he really stressed, is police who are arresting people are at the end of a cycle. They're at the end of, you know, something like low education, low graduation rates, high unemployment. All those things play a factor into what he explained leads to an arrest.
And I believe he also said, you know, at least one of the philosophies is that if you stop, you make a drug arrest, you might stop a shooting down the road as well. So maybe it's not quite as clear cut as it may seem.
Yeah, and that was something that, you know, I really tried to keep in mind is that you can't just take this as a clear cut issue because there's so many socioeconomical factors in play.
Now, to take a look at Appleton, where you talked to the police officer there, what kind of numbers did you turn up in Appleton? Because this was another one that stood out.
In Appleton, which is where I am based, it looked like there was about a 10-to-1 ratio for black arrests over non-black arrests. And I also did the breakdown looking at by crime, because as Chief Lewis said, you really have to consider those factors. And I think one that really stood out to me was that for drug sale or manufacturing, a black person was 20 times more likely to face an arrest.
And in terms of communities with the lower disparities in Wisconsin, which ones were they?
Some of the lowest ones we had were Waupun, Stanley, Adams County, Racine County. And kind of one thing that we noticed a correlation with was that those were also communities with prison populations. And if someone's in prison or in jail, they're certainly not being arrested. So that could play a factor in those low numbers.
Now, I know that some of the police representatives you talked to also addressed this issue of bias and said that maybe it wasn't right to look at police because they try to be at least proactive in screening out applicants who demonstrate bias. How did that come into play?
That was definitely a large part of it. And something Chief Lewis really pointed out is that police, they're one of the very few jobs that try and weed out any potential bias before someone's even hired. They have psychology tests. They have, evaluations to see if there's a potential for a bias that could lead to problems. Something he also pointed out to me was that there's also a chance of an unconscious bias. And one thing that they're trying to bring into our area here in north central Wisconsin is having training to address that potential unconscious bias that people might not even realize is affecting them.
And finally, police leaders also said that it's another way to look at these arrest rates is to look at education in communities, health, opportunity gaps. How do you think that could affect arrest rates, or what would police suggest about that?
One thing that Chief Lewis brought up that really kind of hit home for me was mentioning that some school districts, Appleton is one of them, are trying to implement a 1-to-1 ratio for students and either laptops or iPads or different sort of devices that would give them access to technology that they might not have at home. And one thing he said is that evens the playing field. That makes it easier for these kids who might not have the best home situations, easier for them to graduate, easier for them to find employment, possibly in a technology-related field. And he said that in turn could, you know, lower arrests and lower crime. And he said if we don't address those things, then we're just kind of continuing this cycle.
Now, taken as a whole, what would you say these results tell you about race and arrest rates here in Wisconsin?
Both Ms. Oliver and Chief Lewis said, it's a very complex problem. We can look at this number and say there's a disparity. We can say, you know, there's an imbalance here. But the problem is it takes so much more to be able to say why. And so I guess kind of the goal with this story is to say there is a disparity here, and in some cases it's quite serious, but now we need to figure out why that is and what we can do as a society to address that.
Ariel, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure thing. Thank you.
That was Ariel Chung, a reporter with Gannett Wisconsin Media's iTeam, talking about racial disparities in Wisconsin's arrest rates. With Thanksgiving coming up, What do you think of as the Thanksgiving Day food that defines Wisconsin? Apart from the national standards like turkey and pumpkin pie, is there something that you think of as uniquely Wisconsin? Share your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page or at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
All right, pretty mellow topic, right? Well, here's the weird part. This is controversial all of a sudden. That's thanks to an argument between the New York Times and apparently the entire state of Minnesota. Producer Chris Molina joins us now in the studio. He's really into this story. Chris, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. Thank you, Veronica. I am so into this story. I am really excited to talk about it today.
Okay, so set it up here. The New York Times tries to figure out what?
Yeah, so the New York Times puts out this article last week called The United States of Thanksgiving. It's a big kind of interactive piece on their website. And in it, the editors try to find the quintessential Thanksgiving recipe from each state. I've got how they worded it here. They've said, we've scoured the nation for recipes that evoke each of the 50 states. So picking, you know, a recipe from each state to kind of, you know, define what Thanksgiving means to that state. Maybe not like a turkey dish or anything. Maybe something a little bit offbeat, but something that kind of, you know, I would say reflects the state's culinary heritage a little bit.
And they crowdsource this, right? They actually ask people, presumably from these states.
Right. They asked some people, I believe it was kind of in their immediate network, you know, hey, what recipe do you think would define Thanksgiving in your state? So they did kind of crowdsource it a little bit, yes.
And?
All right. So Wisconsin, not too crazy. What do we get?
Wisconsin, not too crazy. We got wild rice and mushrooms as a Wisconsin dish. You know, I think that probably is a good selection. However, Minnesotans might have something to say about wild rice being omitted for their state dish, because I know wild rice, you know, both states have really rich wild rice traditions. Minnesotans might say that they have it a little bit more. However, some are saying, hey, we are the number one state in the nation for cranberry production. It's our state fruit, for goodness sakes. Why don't we have a cranberry dish? Well, you know, the argument could be made that that would have been a good pick. I think there were two or three states that got cranberry-based dishes, including
Arizona. Yeah, that's weird.
Right, exactly. I mean, not enough water to water your lawn and, you know.
Let alone a cranberry bog, maybe.
Let alone a cranberry bog, yeah,
right.
So.
Before we get to the really weird part, you can call in. What do you think represents Wisconsin? What would you put on the map for Wisconsin's unique Thanksgiving holiday food? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Or if you are across the border, one of our neighbors, what food do you want to see for your state? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we get to the controversy now. Mm-hmm. Chris, what did the New York Times pick as Minnesota's emblematic dish?
This is absolutely great. The dish that they picked to represent Minnesota and the culinary traditions of the United States is something called grape salad. Right? So, I mean, that was kind of the reaction right there. You know, everyone kind of is the stunned silence for a few minutes. They blink their eyes and they say, what? Grape salad? The backlash to this has been swift and it has been severe. The minutes that the New York Times posted this on their Facebook page, the flood of Minnesotans, of good, you know, mild-mannered, passive-aggressive Minnesotans came out of their shell just firing, and they let the New York Times have it, saying, you know, I've lived in Minnesota for decades. I've never heard of this, let alone ever tasted a grape salad. You know, you could have picked anything. You could have picked tater tot hot dish, for goodness sakes. You could have picked anything else. Grape salad. What is grape salad?
Oh, right. What is grape salad?
Yeah.
So the recipe that they have here, I mean, this sounds like something that you might throw together, you know, in college if you've got a couple of things in the refrigerator. it calls for 2 pounds of seedless grapes,
okay.
2 cups of sour cream, mm-hmm. 1 cup of brown sugar, and then if you want to get fancy, you could put some toasted pecans on it. And that's about it. You basically throw it all into a bowl. You mix it together. You put it in the refrigerator for a while, and then you're supposed to take it out and then serve it at room temperature, from what I understand.
Because nothing says Thanksgiving like grape salad with sour cream.
Yeah. So, and again, the social media backlash has just been fierce, and this kind of spawned the Grapegate hashtag.
Hashtag Grapegate.
Yeah, because you can't have a controversy these days without throwing the name Gates after it. So we've got Grapegate now. And, you know, I was reading the New York Times' Facebook page before I came on here, and all the comments on this has to be my absolute favorite. So, and the New York Times said, you know, I've got the quote here. The editor of this, David Tanis, says this grape salad, which falls into the same category of old-fashioned party dishes such as molded jello salad, comes from a Minnesota-born heiress who tells me that it was always part of her holiday buffet. So we've got this comment on social media on Facebook who says, people from Minnesota don't go around introducing themselves as heiresses. This should have been a clue that she wasn't representative of our great state. Now, if she said that she was a dairy princess, mm-hmm. that would have given her some credibility.
All right. Well, unrest on the streets of Lake Wobegon, I'm sure. Well, you can call in now. What food represents your state, Wisconsin, or one of our neighbors on Thanksgiving? What is unique? What is distinctive as Thanksgiving dishes go for our state? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to Douglas in Sparta now. Douglas, hi.
Hey, I was thinking cheese, sausage, and crackers would be pretty Wisconsin dish.
Yeah, I have been to many family Thanksgiving things in Wisconsin that have started. That's what you have out for the snacks beforehand, right? Not necessarily the meal itself, Douglas.
Absolutely.
Okay, it wouldn't be Thanksgiving without that.
No, absolutely not.
And have you ever had grape salad?
Never heard of it.
Never heard of it. Okay. Well,
I've had some fruit salad that had grapes in it, but nobody ever called it grape salad.
All right, Douglas, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234.
You know, and I like that suggestion because I could actually see that on the Thanksgiving spread. Some of the other selections, you know, for this feature article, you know, they've been getting some backlash in a lot of states. I think Maine had, like, lobster mac and cheese, which actually sounds pretty good, but yeah. I couldn't imagine, you know, seeing that on a Thanksgiving table. I wouldn't be opposed to seeing that on the Thanksgiving table. Just doesn't seem like, you know, a dish that would work very well. And I believe another state got glazed bacon. That may have been Pennsylvania.
Glazed bacon.
Well, I'd eat that anyway.
I would certainly eat that. But again, you know, maybe not a great Thanksgiving selection. Mm-hmm. But the cheese and the sausage and the crackers, that sounds perfect for the states.
All right, let's go to another caller now. Dave joins us in Pittsville. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I have a family over in the Twin Cities area, and I have a suggestion for them, particularly those who are Viking fans, and for their Thanksgiving dinner, they could finish it off with some humble pie.
I had a feeling we were going to go there with the Vikings reference. Is a humble pie very tasty, huh? And what about, Dave, have you ever heard of grape salad or had this grape salad we're talking about?
Never, but humble pie with cranberries would be excellent.
Delicious. Thanks, Dave.
All right, thanks, Dave.
I like how you threw the cranberries in there. Let's put the Wisconsin state fruit on the humble pie. Just to, you know, rub it in just a little bit more.
Why stop there? Why not cheese and sausage on the humble
pie?
There
you go.
All right, back to our callers. We've got Andrew on the line now in La Crosse. Andrew, hi there.
Hello. Cranberry fluff. I can't believe they didn't go for that one in Wisconsin.
Cranberry froth. And our producer, Cynthia Schuster, said fruit froth. Now, what is froth?
Fluff.
Oh, she said fluff. Okay, so what's cranberry froth then? I don't know this one.
You just take cranberries, you mix them up with some whipped cream, and throw in a few marshmallows.
That sounds yummy.
It's fluff. I don't know why I keep saying froth.
You're inventing a new thing.
That sounds good, though. I'd eat that.
I would eat that,
I have
too.
Not, but I would.
I like anything with marshmallows and the word fluff in it.
I'm going to come over for Rob's frothy Thanksgiving.
So, Chris, before we go back to a caller, what do you need to see on the table on Thanksgiving in Wisconsin?
You know, one dish that I saw on the list that didn't make it for Wisconsin or Minnesota was a green bean casserole. Oh. And I know that's one that my parents have made a lot in the past, and that's one that I always look forward to. And I think, you know, there's some variation that has copious amounts of cheese in it. So, I mean, the combination of those two things is just fantastic.
Right. We had a listener on the Facebook page who shared that and said it had to be topped with the Funyun onions on top.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I've ever had it like that.
A little bit of crunch. Yeah. All right, let's take another caller here. Bobby joins us in La Crescent, Minnesota. Hi, Bobby.
Hi.
So what do you think about this grape salad thing?
Oh, it's ridiculous. We've been watching the news about it, and you're right. It is. People are outraged at the thought that would represent Minnesota.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, but you know, coming from New York, I guess people in New York may think that's okay. I don't know, but no, people here, nobody that I know of knows what grape salad is. So
okay.
Anyway, but I grew up in Wisconsin. I live in Minnesota now, and growing up and currently, it would not be Thanksgiving at our house without lefse.
Oh.
Lefse. So how do you top it? Do you just butter it up, or do you put some butter and sugar on it at Thanksgiving?
Some people do. My kids like cinnamon and sugar on it. We like, I just like butter on it. At Christmas time, we grew up with this, but we don't serve it very often. We ate it with lutefisk too, the cod soaked in lye.
So you're leaning toward the Norwegian with all of this, huh?
That's right. And you know, Wisconsin and Minnesota both have strong Scandinavian heritages. So I think that that's a reason why it may be true that that's I wouldn't call it a staple, but something very commonly. It's a treat that seems to surface during the holidays anyway.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Bobby. Bobby has never heard of grape salad, but she's going toward the lefse.
Well, and she brought up something there, too, that I think kind of gets at the broader frustration that people are expressing with the story. You know, we're having a good time talking about it, but I think there is some frustration from some people here in the Midwest that maybe when, you know, these highfalutin media sources on the coast try to describe the Midwest, I mean, maybe they think that a dish like grape salad, it kind of reinforces some of those stereotypes. I always think about, there's an episode of How I Met Your Mother when one of the characters brings his fiance to Minnesota and they're making this salad that's like mayonnaise and candy and potato chips all in one. So, I mean, it's kind of there. So I think there is some frustration there. You know, we are having some fun with this, but I do think there is some frustration that, you know, hey, the Midwest isn't flyover country. We really love living here and we've got a lot to offer.
Chris, real quick, any chance you'll make this grape salad just to say you've tried it?
I might have to try it. I know my Minnesota girlfriend would love it.
Well, Chris, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was Central Time producer Chris Molina, and you can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page.
In middle and high school, the sport you play can say a lot about you. This year, Wisconsin schools added an unexpected option, mountain biking. The state is only the 12th in the country to offer the opportunity for students to compete in this adrenaline-heavy, demanding outdoor sport. Laurel White visited a race recently and filed this report.
It's a brisk fall day, and around two dozen athletes are at the starting line. The countdown ends, and the cyclists begin the climb up a steep hill. This is the last race of the first season of the Wisconsin High School Cycling League. There are 16 teams, and they come from all over the state. Cedarburg, Janesville, Wausau, Maquanago. Kathy Mock, whose son Dax is racing today, is one of the founders of the league. She says mountain biking is drawing a lot of interest because it's a sport that lets everyone play.
The number one thing I would say, nobody sits the bench. You never sit the bench. At a practice, nobody sits the bench. At an event, if you want to race, nobody sits the bench.
Riders also love that it connects them with the outdoors. Ava Miller, a 17-year-old rider from Shorewood, says that's definitely a draw for her.
Being out on the trails and just you and knowing how, like, I just like being outside and, like, on the trails.
Today, Ava has some pre-race jitters.
Very nervous. I have butterflies.
But she has a good strategy to cope.
I usually have songs going through my mind to take it off how tired my legs are.
It's a competition, but the atmosphere around the grounds is friendly. Riders are bundled up in puffy coats, their folding chairs pulled in tight next to each other. They're laughing and eating sandwiches their parents brought. 15-year-old Hannah Mork and 13-year-old McKenna Dwyer have gone back and forth, alternating getting first and second in girls' JV races all season. They're fierce competitors, but they're also really good friends. Hannah and McKenna caused a lot of commotion on the grounds around noon. First, people started jogging from the woods, where the riders were about to merge to go down the home stretch. Then the whole crowd started running toward the finish line. The girls were neck and neck.
I was leading the first lap, and then she passed me at the single track back there, and then I would just stay on her wheel for the last two laps. Like, the whole third lap, I was trying to shake her, and she wouldn't drop, and, you know, then I was thinking, great, it's going to come down to the final sprint, and that got me scared, because we raced here, like, about a year ago, and she got me, like, in a sprint, so I knew, like, it could be like that again, and, you know, when we turned that corner and we were all out sprinting it, and I could see I had a wheel of her, and so then when I finished line, I was like, wow.
Hannah ended up winning by half a second. Of the four races this season, Hannah won two and McKenna won two. So who gets the season high point trophy?
we talked about it and we said yeah. we both deserve it. So whatever happens, we're sharing.
Yeah, we're
splitting
share,
it.
Share the title.
Yeah.
League officials agreed.
And your 2014 co-JV champions from Wausau United Ride and Camrock Composite, respectively, Hannah Mork and McKenna Dwyer.
And so ended the first season of the Wisconsin High School Cycling League. Organizers expect the league to grow next year, and McKenna and Hannah, as well as some of their teammates, are hoping to make it to nationals. Until then, riders will train for next fall. For now, they may need some snow tires on those mountain bikes. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Paying for college isn't getting any easier these days. Tuition and fees seem to be going up, causing lots of students to rack up debt, which could have serious consequences down the road.
But our next guest says that paying for college doesn't have to ruin you for life, and there are hidden resources, little-known cost-cutting methods, and money-saving strategies to successfully plan and pay for college. And if done right, it can be possible to graduate without the burden of all that debt.
Joining us now is Lynette Calfani-Cox. She's the CEO and co-founder of The Money Coach. She's also a former financial news journalist and the author of the new book, College Secrets, How to Save Money, Cut College Costs, and Graduate Debt-Free. Her website is askthemoneycoach.com. Lynette, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me back on the show. Good to be with you both.
So graduating debt-free, that sounds like a lofty, if not kind of impossible, goal. How achievable is that?
Sounds like a pipe dream, right? Well, it's definitely the case that most students do have student loans when they get out of school. In fact, right now, if you look at some of the latest statistics, about 70% of all students, all college grads, do have student loans, and they're up to, you know, about $33,000 in debt when you look at the class of 2014. But my message is to tell people that with some planning and some preparation, certainly with some sort of insider knowledge about what's available and out there to you, you can definitely drastically slash the cost of college. And yes, it is possible to even graduate debt-free. Hmm.
Well, I imagine for a lot of families, in an ideal world, the planning for college would begin sometime around when the baby is born, when they adopt, right away, instead
exactly.
of when it probably happens in the real world, which is somewhere much later down the road. How early should college planning begin?
Well, you're right that it should start in an ideal world. It would start, like, once the kid is born. But, you know, obviously we don't live in a perfect society. None of us are perfect people. And the fact of the matter is that life gets in the way. Everybody's dealing with a whole host of bills. They're juggling the mortgage or the rent payments. They've got utilities. They got to put, you know, food on the table, car notes. So there's all these other obligations, the sort of day-to-day that gets in the way that, of course, makes it difficult for most folks to think about saving for a longer-term goal, like, say, college, if they have a three-year-old or whatever. But, yes, you have phenomenally more options and potentially more strategies that you can use if you start at a younger age. But I don't want to discourage your listeners who feel like, oh, my God, I'm a late starter. I have a kid in junior high school or a kid in high school or even a kid who's a senior and who's doing the college apps right now, like my daughter is doing, and because they can, in fact, make some smart choices as well that can reduce their student loan burden as well.
Well, what are a couple specific rules of thumb that can help people plan no matter what the stage?
Well, I guess the first thing that I tell all families, certainly the parents who are frequently footing the bill as well as the students, is that you really shouldn't think about college costs in terms of what I call the upfront costs. That's the tuition, fees, room and board. So we all hear a lot about, you know, tuition escalating and the expensive nature of room and board. But frankly, that's only a fraction of the totality of college expenses. And people should be thinking about the hidden side of college as well, the sort of back-end expenses, because that's where most families pay a lot of out-of-pocket expenses. So families who actually have students who get scholarships based on merit or even need-based aid if they've applied for financial aid, they can frequently get their tuition lowered. And in fact, you know, a lot of schools discount tuition to the tune of 50% or more. So you may get, you know, scholarship money or need-based aid to help cover the tuition, but all of that stuff that happens when your kid is in school, the parking fees on campus, that fifth year of study, whether or not they join a fraternity or a sorority, whether or not they do internships, whether or not they go and study abroad, nobody really talks too much about that stuff, and that's the back-end cost of college that takes a lot of families by surprise. So by knowing what resources are available to tackle some of those hidden expenses, you can, in fact, defray those costs tremendously.
Right. So quickly before we move on, how do you get a reasonable estimate about what that might be for your student?
It ain't easy. Unfortunately, it's not easy at all. And, you know, I literally spent 2 years worth of research to write College Secrets and the companion book, College Secrets for Teens, to really do the heavy lifting for a lot of families, to go online, to visit a number of campuses all across the country, to talk to financial aid specialists, admissions counselors, high school guidance counselors, et cetera. In a nutshell, though, it's ultimately up to each family to do a lot of homework. But I think part of it is just knowing in advance what expenses you are likely to encounter. So, you know, most people don't know about tuition differential charges or surcharges if they have certain majors. So, you know, if your kid is an engineering major or a music major, journalism, photography major, that kind of thing, expect that the price that you see online, there's going to be an adjustment or an additional cost factored into that. You know, if you think that your kid might want to do some academic field work or maybe some research projects, expect that there will be a cost associated with that. Expect to get hit up while the kid is in school for all kinds of memorabilia. So tell your kid, stay out of that bookstore on campus. That's usually one of the worst places to buy things, including college textbooks. So part of it is arming yourself with knowledge beforehand to know, okay, these are the other expenses that nobody told me about. Now let me think about how I'm going to tackle some of these college costs, or frankly, how I can even eliminate them entirely, because I really do believe that a lot of people could completely forego certain things or at least reduce the cost dramatically.
Well, looking at that college tuition, which I think is sort of the sticker shock a lot of people get when they're checking out colleges, you say that's not that relevant to what you're talking about. Now, part of it is you're saying, look at the back end cost that we just talked about. But what about the tuition itself? How can we negotiate that and get a better deal?
Well, I outlined 16 strategies to reduce college tuition. And it's everything from, of course, taking advantage of in-state bargains to looking at colleges that are offering a degree in 3 years. So, of course, you'll get a bachelor's or of arts or a bachelor of science degree, a four-year degree. But there are many schools that say, here, we'll help you to complete it more quickly. So that third year is way better on the living side than paying for 4 years worth of college. I talk about getting what I call the sort of two-step option going if you think your child might do better at a community college. The caveat there, because frankly the research is not so good in favor of those who start off at a community college in terms of college completion rates or actually being able to transfer credits to four-year institutions. So the caveat I would give there is to make sure that you have what's called an articulation agreement in place to make sure those credits do in fact transfer. But you can get tuition waivers. You can prepay certain amounts for college. You can do creative things like attending either school overseas or maybe even going to a no-tuition college. Yes, they do exist. You can even think about ways that you can work in certain fields where the college itself might pay your tuition. So it's about, again, getting a little bit creative. And even for some people, they might say, well, listen, I'm not going to necessarily go to school in Wisconsin. I want to go out of state. And, of course, we all know that out-of-state tuition typically is 2 to 3 times more for non-residents. So one of the strategies there is to make sure that you go through a regional exchange program if you're looking to go out of state. And in a nutshell, a regional exchange program is one where students in sort of nearby territories or states are able to get the same rate as in-state students or at least pay a lot less than out-of-state students typically pay. So in your neck of the woods, for instance, there's the Midwest Student Exchange, and it's available to students in nine different states. So if someone in Wisconsin wasn't going to go in-state, maybe they were going to go to one of your neighboring states in, say, Minnesota or Michigan or maybe Illinois, they can save a lot of money just by going through the Midwest Student Exchange. They agree to essentially cap the tuition that students pay if they come from out of state. They cap it at no more than a maximum of 1.5 times the in-state resident tuition rate, and that's for public schools.
We're talking right now with financial expert Lynette Kalfani-Cox about planning and paying for college with an end goal of graduating debt-free. And we'd like you to join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
If you're getting ready to go to college or the parent of a soon-to-be student, what questions do you have about tackling college costs? If you've already earned your degree, how did you pay for it? Do you have some tips and tricks that you use to save a few bucks and keep debt down along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with financial planning expert Lynette Kalfani-Cox about how to cut college costs and how to get a degree without racking up massive debt in the process. You can join our conversation with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234.
If you are in the planning stages, if you have some questions, share your thoughts, or if you have done it and managed to graduate debt-free, tell us how you did it. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we take a caller right now. We've got Alex joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a comment. I'm currently a college student at UW Green Bay in my senior year, and I've been fortunate enough to be awarded a few different scholarships. And so I would say scholarships are an option to keep at the forefront of the mind for any person looking to get into a college or currently in college, for parents as well, because I sat down and crunched the numbers, and even with small scholarships that haven't covered all of my tuition costs, I've been able to, in a way, pay myself more than any employer has ever paid me, upwards of $20 an hour for the time it takes to fill out a scholarship application, or even in considering ones that I fail to be awarded, but just the one or two that I get. So basically saying it's definitely an economic smart move, even if you lose, mm-hmm. you know, 9 out of 10 scholarships.
And Alex, did you have to go hunting for those scholarships, or were they pretty easy to find?
Relatively easy to find. There's, you know, a good laundry list full of websites that there are scholarships, but the ones that are best to hunt down, I've noticed, have been the ones that your university or the university lists.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Alex. He's got some ideas about going after the scholarships.
Sure. And Alex makes a great point about essentially the ROI involved here, the return on investment. You know, a lot of students won't take the time and effort that it takes to secure those scholarships because they think, oh, my God, there's so many people applying, or what are my chances or my odds? But you know what? If you get it, like he said, the return is phenomenal, because even a $500 scholarship, a $1,000 scholarship, if you spent 8 hours on it, and you probably won't spend that much time on it, you're getting way more than you would get certainly working for an employer, you know, getting paid minimum wage, essentially. But one of the things that I talk about in College Secrets in terms of how to avoid student loan debt is that scholarships and grants, which are, of course, free money that don't have to be repaid, that's definitely one of the 5 different ways that you should look at funding a college education without resorting to loans.
Well, thanks so much, Alex. Let's go on next to Brian in Milwaukee. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Yes, thank you for letting me talk. When we have children, we should recognize that it's our decision to have the children, not the children's decision to be born. And so we take responsibility as parents for their lives. It doesn't stop at the age of 18. And therefore, I mean, I know understanding different people's economic situations and things that come up that can't be, foreseen. But in general, it should be the parents should put out money and save money for their children to have a college education.
Okay, thanks. Brian is saying that it's his responsibility as a parent to look out for the kids and make sure that there's some money in the bank. What do you say to that? It's a nice ideal, obviously.
I actually agree personally because I know that for my children, I don't want them to have any student loans whatsoever, and I don't want to borrow on their behalf as well. The reality is that most families haven't done, quote-unquote, on paper, the right thing. They've not saved adequately and sufficiently. But if we're talking about either a moral imperative, a moral responsibility, or even a legal responsibility, he's definitely correct that in many states, your obligation to provide for your child's welfare and well-being does not, I repeat, does not just automatically terminate at the age of majority, say 18 or even 21. I'm in New Jersey, and in fact, there was a major case here recently where a student who was from New Jersey sued her parents, and a court sided with her based on state Supreme Court law that said, yes, the parents, and she was 21, the parents must pay for her college education. So he's right, certainly from a legal standpoint, and then we can debate the merits about some people say, let them work for themselves. I had to work to put myself through school. In College Secrets, I talk about why it's not, I repeat, not financially possible for the average student today to sort of pull him or herself up by the bootstraps and completely put her, you know, themselves through school. It can be done in some cases, especially if you do the junior college route, et cetera. But at the average four-year institution, which is $20,000-plus per year for a public school and $40,000 average annual cost all in for private schools, they'd be working 40-plus hours a week and would never finish on time.
Well, Lynette, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today. That was Lynette Kalfani-Cox. Her new book is called College Secrets, How to Save Money, Cut College Costs, and Graduate Debt-Free.